All right, buddy, welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. So today, we're going to be talking a little bit about the White House is launching a new investigation. And the investigation is into social media and how it's basically destroying kids and their mental health and other problems that are associated with it. So I may have a take that will surprise you on that front. We also have stories now about how the right is dropping any pretense of not being fascists because some of them are just saying it now. They're coming out and they're saying, we need a dictator. So, okay. All right. Well, I guess points for honesty, I guess you can say. And then we also have some new numbers about just how many victims of Catholic Church sex abuse there are. Really, really astonishing stuff. You're not going to want to miss it. And then you have a host on MSNBC laughs in the face of a Republican politician when the Republican politician cannot stop lying and face plants in what effectively is a debate. So we have all that stuff and much, much more. All right, let's go ahead and dive into it. So there's been a lot of talk recently about Joe Biden's age. We just covered the other day, Hillary Clinton came out and said, yeah, it's an issue. It's an issue. Now, she also went on to say, well, you know, I like his record. He did a good job. He's running again. I'm going to support him. But, you know, voters are going to take into account his age. The reason why this is becoming more and more of an issue is because apparently he just tripped at the G7 summit in Japan or whatever. And so people are like, damn, you know, this seemed kind of out of it, bro. There's been reports that he doesn't really hold meetings after 4 p.m. in the afternoon because he can't really, he's not mentally with it anymore. I mean, he's not Dianne Feinstein level, but I don't know how long until he gets there, if I'm being totally honest with you guys. So, of course, cue the media to rush in and basically run cover for Joe Biden, play defense for Joe Biden. So you guys know the landscape. Fox News is the Republican propaganda network. MSNBC is the corporate Democrat propaganda network. CNN tries to do a little bit of both. I mean, this is the landscape that we're talking about. So here's Charles Blow on MSNBC, and listen to his monologue here.
As we start the second hour, we want to flip the script on how President Biden's re-election campaign is perceived. The common wisdom in much of the news media is that Biden might struggle, maybe definitely is struggling with parts of the electorate in 2024 because of how voters view his age. But in a recent piece in the New York Times, I argue there's a chicken and egg aspect to this coverage. Now, let me say up front that a candidate's age and competency are always fair game in politics. Even Biden conceded earlier this month that he took a hard look at his age as he contemplated whether to seek re-election.
One of the things that people are going to find out, they're going to see a race, and they're going to judge whether or not I have it or don't have it. I respect them taking a hard look at it. I take a hard look at it as well. I took a hard look at it before I decided to run. And I feel good. I feel excited about the prospects.
But there are other truths that must be considered. As I wrote in the Times, headlines and polls don't just measure and reflect public sentiment. They also influence public sentiment.
Let's pause there for a second. His piece in the Time includes the subtitle here, The Manufactured Panic Over Biden's Age. Manufactured? Manufactured. Now, people have eyes, bro. People have eyes. And look, I want to be clear. To me, the issue is not the age per se. The issue is whether or not you are cognitively able to do the job. Now, I'm not talking even about ideology, which to me is the biggest factor, right? Like, are you for the right things? I'm just talking about, are you cognitively present? Obviously, the worst place to be on that spectrum is Dianne Feinstein level. Biden may not be there just yet, but the question is, how far away is he? Now, I don't want to go ahead and pull up the compilations, but you guys know they're out there, and I've shown them to you on the show time and time again. The compilations of him being unable to complete a sentence, stumbling over his words, embarrassingly face-planting. Now, there's compilations like that for a lot of politicians, but Biden's is pretty goddamn long. And remember, it was other Democratic candidates in the 2020 presidential race who kept bringing up, hey, man, you've lost at least a step, maybe two, maybe even three. It was Julian Castro who said, did you just forget what you said two minutes ago? You just contradicted yourself. You said the opposite 2 minutes ago. So this was fair game when the establishment wanted a Pete Buttigieg. Fair game when the establishment wanted other corporate Democrats to take the lead and be the chosen one, like Kamala Harris. But then all of a sudden, when Biden was the last option and he became the one, the media did a total reversal. It was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. But to me, the more important and more egregious part is what? With Bernie Sanders, it was all age, his age, too old. Now with Biden, they're like, his age ain't nothing but a number, bro. It's just nothing but a number, bro.
It must be considered. As I wrote in the Times, headlines and polls don't just measure and reflect public sentiment, they also influence public sentiment. The persistence of a theme elevates and validates that theme. It's true that if he's reelected, Biden would be the oldest president we've ever had. But he is already the oldest president we've already had the first time he was elected. So what has changed? I'd argue that the biggest change wasn't the simple passage of time, but the decision of some Republican leaders to focus like a laser on Biden's age as the factor weighing against him, and then how the media responded to that heightened focus. Editorial decisions can be influenced by campaigns, and coverage can influence voters as much as inform those voters. From my piece in the Times, the idea that voters are worried about Biden's age and capacity has been repeated so often that it no longer requires any proof beyond polling that reflects what respondents have consumed.
So in other words, the narrative is only a narrative because the media is talking about it. If the media didn't talk about it, people wouldn't notice. Well, number one, people do notice. Number two, the media only brings it up to slap aside any questions around it. Though, okay, he looks old. Anyway, moving on. He's the one. So this is doubly incorrect, which is impressive. That is an impressive feat.
Of course, that they're worried about Biden's age and capacity. Breathless headlines have created a sense that worry about the president's age is common and common sense, when in fact, at least in part, it is fueled by political manipulation and by media complicity. So as the 2024 election cycle begins in earnest, maybe we in the news media should let the voters decide what's most important to them and stop deciding for the voters.
That's that last part there. That's the part that got me. That's the part that got me. You want to let the voters decide. You want to let the voters decide? How many articles have you written on Marianne Williamson? Charles Blow. How many articles have you written on RFK Jr.? How many times has the publication that you worked for, or you work for, the New York Times, how many times have they covered her? How many times has MSNBC talked about her? How many times has CNN talked about her? Is she getting a fair shake? Is she doing that? If you want to let the voters decide, you should be talking about all options that are on the menu. But you're not doing that. In fact, quite the opposite. Every single time Marianne is mentioned, it comes with the words, unserious candidate. Not a serious candidate. Not a real challenge. Oh, on that, you should definitely let the voters decide. You should give her fair coverage. You should give her objective coverage. I said it before, even if they're just going after her relentlessly, I would like that more than complete and utter indifference, which is what we're currently faced with. That's how they try to snuff out a movement. Just pretend like this person's not even running for president. And so then it's on everybody else to circumvent the media who are controlling the narrative. But he's not complaining about that, not at all. What he's complaining about is the media kind of sort of not really talking about how Biden's a little bit old and he's not there mentally anymore. But he doesn't even mention the fact that whenever the media does bring it up, they then swat aside the question and say, oh, that's, I don't know what you're talking about. With Bernie, it's can't do it. With Biden, it's okay, yeah, but he's not Trump. He's not Trump, so, you know, everybody be cool. Be cool. He's still okay. He's still with it enough. Just when these media networks become the living embodiment of the caricature of them, whoo, boy, does that get under my skin. And that's exactly what this is right here. So to me, what you're about to see here is a very interesting conversation. The White House has decided to put a whole bunch of effort into basically launching an investigation into social media and how it's affecting particularly young people. Now, you know, I don't know. Are they also going to branch out and see how it's affecting older people? I don't know. But the idea is, hey, look, we all have eyes. We all see that Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, all these different social media outlets, they kind of are a menace. They're kind of ruining everybody's mental health. This is the argument that's made. Depression, anxiety, all these different things they think are linked to social media use, or more specifically, overuse. And so they just announced this task force that they're launching. So let's listen to the White House press spokesperson, and I'll react to it.
Today, during National Mental Health Awareness Month, the Biden-Harris administration is announcing the development of a new interagency task force on kids, online health and safety, and a series of additional actions from several agencies to safeguard children's privacy, mental health, and safety online. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy also released a new advisory on social media and youth mental health that calls on policymakers, technology companies, researchers, parents, and young people to work together to make social media safer for kids. These new administration-wide actions will help advance President Biden's national strategy to tackle the mental health crisis and protect the health and well-being of our nation's young people.
Okay, so that's what the White House press spokesperson said. Now, you also have the Surgeon General. The U.S. Surgeon General is going around different media outlets, and here's what he had to say. This is Vivek Murthy.
Well, we're living in the middle of a youth mental health crisis in America, and I've said before this is the defining public health issue of our time. And the reason I'm issuing this advisory is I am very concerned now that social media is an important factor that is driving this youth mental health crisis. You know, I talk to parents all across the country, and the most common question that they ask me is social media safe for my kids? And the truth is, when we look at the collection of publicly available evidence, when we talk to researchers and subject matter experts, we can't say that social media is, in fact, safe for our kids. And in fact, what we do see is growing evidence of harms. And specifically, you think about the fact that kids who use more than 3 hours of social media a day face a greater risk, in fact, double the risk of depression and anxiety symptoms. This is especially concerning when you consider the fact that the average amount of use by kids is 3.5 hours a day. So the bottom line is, this is a real point of concern here. When nearly half of kids are telling us that social media use makes them feel worse about their body image, I think about that as a father who has two young children. And I want what every parent wants. I want my kids to grow up confident, to grow up feeling good about themselves. I want them to be able to thrive. We should make sure that social media is, in fact, a place where our kids get benefits and where they're not harmed.
So is it true that social media increases depression, anxiety, a whole cadre of psychological issues among young people? I'm sure there's some truth to that. I have no doubt that there's some truth to that. And that, you know, everybody should be aware of that. Now, the other part of it, which is a politically incorrect thing to say, but I think it's also true, is that nobody ever really mentions that these platforms, for all of their flaws, are also a tremendous benefit. They can be a tremendous benefit. People can find community. People can get interested in certain hobbies as a result of what they see on social media. People can make friends, significant others. It could be a form of healthy escapism from a real world scenario, which perhaps is not so good for a kid. So I feel like we don't have a balanced conversation about social media. Yes, there are potential downsides, particularly with the overuse of social media and various algorithmic problems. But there are also tremendous upsides. Now, I don't know, maybe people just default assume everybody knows there are a lot of upsides too, which is why they're so popular in the first place, so that's why they don't bring it up. I don't know, right? But I think both of those things matter. Now, here's where I run into a problem with this. We don't even have universal healthcare, bro. This country doesn't even have universal healthcare. So never mind going a step further to have our universal healthcare system include mental healthcare. You know what I'm in favor of? I'm in favor of single-payer Medicare for all, universal healthcare. I'm in favor of that including mental healthcare. I think you have a right, not just to healthcare for your physical body, but also your mental health, because guess what? The brain is part of the body. So it's also a physical thing in a very literal sense. So for them to pick this issue, hone in on this issue, why is it such a narrow focus? as opposed to, hey, if you really want to fix this problem, you really want to help people who have depression and anxiety and all these different psychological issues, the first thing you do is try to get universal mental health care for people so they can actually get it addressed. But they're not doing that. Instead, they're studying the impact social media has on our younger generation. Now, the reason this is a problem is, what are you going to do with any findings? Let's say you do find, hey, there's a massive increase in all these mental health issues as a result of social media. What are you going to do? What's your solution? My guess is it'll be recommendations to strictly regulate social media to make it less free, to have more controls, more top-down controls from the government. I mean, that's the only thing I could think of. What else could this, what else could they recommend coming out of this? They're not going to say, hey, you're doing great. Hands off. Everything's fine. They're going to say, hey, maybe we need to limit the amount of time these kids are on. Maybe we need to have government mandated certain algorithms that are healthier. There's a list of things they could do, minimum age to use social media, whatever. And for any potential solution they would propose, it almost certainly is going to be not something I agree with. Because I'm in a weird place because I acknowledge that social media can have detrimental effects for kids' health and even adults' health. But I don't want the government to be the one to step in and provide any sort of solution which would present a bigger problem than the original problems. I don't want the government being involved in any sort of new top-down regulatory structure to deal with social media because I think, you know, my perspective on it, this is the public square now. So you, in my opinion, you have a First Amendment right to sort of speak your mind on social media. That doesn't mean you can do direct threats of violence or whatever, but it does mean I do want a hands-off approach. This is where my, you know, I'm a libertarian leftist. So on social issues, I'm very hands-off, live and let live. It's on economic issues that I say, no, we need to do redistribution of wealth and regulate the system and make it more fair to give everybody an equal shot. I want the government involved on the economic side. On the social side, I don't want the government involved almost at all. Very minimal involvement of the government. So I don't think this is a good idea. I don't think this, because nothing good is going to come from it. So what's my recommendation? My recommendation is very simple. Control your goddamn kids, right? Make your own rules. Make your own rules about how often they can use it, what they're able to see. And guess what? All these social media outlets have features, like kid-friendly versions or whatever, right? Most of these social media outlets have that option. There are ways you can make it so that certain things are accessible and certain things are not accessible, etc. I mean, that's the solution. Get it together, fix it yourself. But again, more importantly, if the government's going to get involved in any way, shape, or form, get us universal health care, including universal mental health care. Because then you have a serious conversation about fixing issues that are facing kids. But beyond that, also, you can't discuss this without getting into, hey, maybe there's a lot of other reasons kids are depressed and anxious. Maybe it has a lot to do with living in late stage capitalism, a society that's, you know, rotting around them on a regular basis, corroding around them on a regular basis. We have more income and wealth inequality than the Gilded Age. We have people loaded to the gills with debt. We have a social safety net that's, you know, incredibly meager. Maybe you have to address some of those root causes in order to give people some more material well-being so they have a chance to thrive more. But no, they would never focus on that because they brought us the late-stage capitalism. The corruption, the bribery, the money in politics has gotten us to where we are now. And they're never going to recommend, hey, let's actually just fix our entire economic system, right? They would never recommend that. So instead, let's micro-focus on social media and probably come up with recommendations that are strict and authoritarian and overly regulatory. I don't want that. I don't want that. Parents can take care of their kids, you know, social media use, come up with rules, enforce those rules, and we should have universal mental health care, and that's how you treat this. And other than that, fix the root causes of the problem in society, but they don't want to do that. They never want to do that. They'd rather get involved and have this be their main focus. Again, now you're acting like you care about people now. You're acting like you care about people now when 45,000 people die in this country every year because they don't have basic health care. But, oh, you're so concerned about the kids? Spare me. Spare me. We know what to do to actually fix it. You don't want to do any of those things. You'd rather take control of social media from the top down. And my guess is there's probably some underlying motivations that are somewhat nefarious there about how they want to control the narrative. This wild, wild west, way too free social media is a problem to them. It's a problem. And so they like to get their hands on it and control it. Every now and then we get a moment where somebody on the right is a little too honest. They're a little too honest. And, you know, on the one hand, props for being real with us. But on the other hand, it's like, when you let that mask slip and show us who you really are, whoo, boy, is it ugly. It is super ugly. So this is in Mediaite. They say, pro-Trump Fox News regular comes right out and says it, quote, "This country needs a dictator." So it's this guy right here. His name is Jesse Kelly. You see, for those of you who are listening to the audio version of the podcast and you can't see what's on screen is a picture of him. He was a regular on Tucker Carlson's show. And I know him because I covered a segment that he was in where he very famously said, "We should be sitting on a throne of Chinese skulls." And Tucker was nodding along. Anti-war Tucker Carlson was nodding along in agreement. Like, yes, genocide the Chinese and sit on a throne of their skulls. I'm very anti-war and anti-elitist. That's who this guy is. That's the last big moment he gave us that we talked about. Well, now he gives us this banger that we need a dictator. They say pro-Trump podcaster Jesse Kelly, a frequent guest on the canceled program of former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, declared that the United States needs a dictator in an alarming tweet. Quote, "Let me tell you all an uncomfortable truth. This country needs a dictator." Kelly tweeted to his nearly 640,000 followers. He's got more followers than me, man. That's wild. It's not like this guy doesn't have influence in right-wing circles. As the great John Adams said, a free country only works for a moral people. We are not worthy of freedom. A dictator is coming. So in other words, Americans are not moral people and they don't deserve freedom. How do you even respond to stuff like this? I mean, I'll state the obvious. I actually do think we're a moral people. If you look at polling numbers, Americans intuitively get very basic things. Intuitively, without maybe knowing the specifics and the particulars, they'll tell you, yeah, I think we should have higher taxes on the rich. Yeah, I think we should have universal health care. Yeah, I think we should have higher wages. Now, every now and then there's an issue where I happen to disagree with the general sentiment, majoritarian sentiment in this country. But most of the time, that's not the case. I agree probably 80, 90% with it. So I'm a moderate in that sense. I'm a centrist. I'm right smack dab in the center of mainstream American opinion. This guy despises his fellow Americans. He despises them. He has nothing but contempt looking down his nose at you. Ironically, this is the right-wing version. Remember when Hillary Clinton said that thing that became, it was a huge story when she said the basket of deplorables or whatever called half of Trump supporters that. And that was huge because the right was like, look, you just hate Americans. So noted, like, we hate you too, right? Like, that was the reaction from Fox. He's doing the right-wing version of that. Americans don't deserve freedom because they're not moral people. So in other words, he's a smug elitist looking down on regular people. And he actively wants a dictator. So in other words, he's embracing authoritarianism. He's embracing controlling every aspect of your life. Well, thank you for saying it. Thank you for coming out and being honest. Because now, when you bear this to the world, not many people are going to ride with you, bro. So they say, one Twitter user responded, "Weimar problems eventually lead to Weimar solutions." Whoo! So that's somebody being like, well, Nazi Germany happened because it was the solution to Weimar. So if America's in a Weimar situation, well, maybe we need our own Hitler. Maybe we'll get our own Hitler. Wow. Kelly simply responded to that tweet, quote, "There it is. So not only does he want a dictator, he wants a certain flavor and variety of dictator. One that perhaps rhymes with Schmadoff Splittler." These guys are unbelievable. At least one follower nominated Kelly himself for dictator, saying, "Sign me up for 4 years of Supreme Leader Kelly." Could you imagine having this much of a cucked mindset? Being this much of a simp? To a podcaster? Listen, people are fans of all different types of podcasters or whatever. You guys are fans of me, I hope, at least, right? But goddammit, none of you would sink this low. None of you would be like, yes, become our emperor, overlord, god king, Kyle. You control everything. Jesus Christ. Kelly followed up by tweeting, I don't want to be a dictator. Dictators are awful. All I'm saying is one is coming and we deserve him. So they're awful, but I support them, which means I support awful things. Again, thank you. This guy's not the brightest. They're not sending their best. The right-wing pundits are not sending their best. Another follower posted, I read that as him giving a warning, not advocating for a dictator, and asked Kelly for clarification on his comment. Kelly declined to explain, quote, listen to this. I don't give clarifications. What I said is right there for everyone to read. It's quite plain and simple. The perpetually offended dork wing will take it how they take it. The get it people will understand it. It needs no further clarification at all. In other words, no, bitch, I didn't stutter. We need a dictator. I want a dictator. I'm pro-dictator. That's what he's saying. Now, thankfully, there were some conservatives who took outrage with this, who took issue with this, because there's some conservatives who their version of conservatism is like, I want smaller government. I want to give the people more freedom. There's all different kinds of conservatism. There's like traditionalism as conservatism. You know, that's one idea. There's smaller government as conservatism. There's dictator apologia as conservatism, like authoritarianism as conservatism. There's all these different varieties. So one of these guys chimed in. Apparently, this is more the small government type conservative, Noah Bloom. He says, quote, getting a Hitler to own the libs. Hear, hear. Gnome. Oh, I said Noah. I think it's Gnome Bloom. I couldn't have said it any better myself. That's all that animates this guy is hatred of liberals. That's it. That's it. You cannot base your entire politics around who you hate. That will warp your mind. That will rot your brain. It's not just about what you're against. It's what you're for. What are you in favor of? What makes sense? How should we organize society? These people just feel like, I hate liberals. And if that means we get an authoritarian dictator to control every aspect of everybody's life and we have no civil rights, no freedom, no liberty, no justice, well, I'm A-okay with that because I hate liberals. Kelly, a veteran of the Iraq War. Oh, what a surprise. He was probably directly involved in killing brown people overseas. What a surprise. This does not seem like a guy I trust with a weapon in a war. Do I think he's going to be meticulous about making sure he doesn't kill civilians? No. Quite the opposite. A veteran of the Iraq War gained notoriety on Twitter for trollish and sometimes violent commentary in support of former President Donald Trump. He ran for Congress twice in Arizona in 2010 and 2012, losing both times. Thank the good Lord that Arizona has some common sense. Even some conservatives there were like, you know what? Little too much. This was not the first time Kelly has mused about the U.S. being under the control of a dictator. In a 2021 appearance on Tucker Carlson Tonight, Kelly claimed that Republicans will soon elect a fascist because of how Hunter Biden was being treated. These guys are unbelievable. Now, would he say the opposite of that? Would he say, hold on now, Jared Kushner is just as corrupt, if not more corrupt than Hunter Biden. Jared Kushner took $2 billion from the Saudis. $2 billion. And he allegedly was slipping Mohammed bin Salman classified information as a result of it. The Trump administration did all sorts of favors for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia paid them back. Jared Kushner got $2 billion. Trump got tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars from the Saudis for the LIV golf tournaments. So super corrupt as corrupt can be. Would he say, because of the treatment of Jared Kushner, this might lead to a left-wing socialist government, and they deserve that? He would never say that. No. It's just, I want excuses to have an overlord daddy, authoritarian dictator who gets to control everything. Again, because I hate the liberals. Okay. So now, lest you think this is the end of the story, well, think again, because it seems to be all at once, all these different figures on the right, on the far right, these pundits, they can't even pretend anymore to not be fascists, because now we have this. Joshua Abatoy, he's the managing director at New Founding Org, executive director of AM American Reformer, and the Claremont Institute, which is, by the way, a very well-known conservative organization. Okay. He says, basically, America is going to need a Protestant Franco. For those of you who don't know, Franco was a Catholic dictator in Spain. And this guy's saying we need a Protestant version of Franco. So we need a dictator in the United States who's a Protestant. And then when there are plenty of people in the replies saying, like, what? Dog, that's crazy. He says, hearing from a lot of pearl clutchers in the quote tweets, who in my estimation are far too sanguine about the durability of the status quo. But what is the specific contention? That the communists were preferable to Franco? Because, you know, that's the only option. Fascist dictator, authoritarian communist. That's it. There's no other options on the table. No other options on the menu. The thing that's so astonishing to me is just how dumb these guys are. Because there's a million problems with having a dictator, right? But one of the biggest things is like, okay, if we're going to all agree, our system is just going to be a dictatorship from now until whenever, till the end of time. Do they not realize that when one dictator dies and then the power vacuum is filled by the strongest person the next time around and we have a new dictator, do you think you're going to agree with the dictator every time there's a new dictator? So if you say, hey, I want a dictator, and the first one happens to be very far right, and then the next time around, maybe get a Stalin-type character, right? He fills the power vacuum. So now you have somebody who has total control, no checks and balances, but they say, you know what, let's nationalize every industry in the country. And, so, and it's like, oh, no, not like that. When I said I wanted a dictator, what I meant was, I want somebody who agrees with me on 100% of things. Yeah, but even if we had a dictator, even if you think that's the dictator you want, it's not going to be the case you agree with them on 100% of things, and there's no recourse. There's no checks and balances. There's no way to try to course correct. So it's just such a simp, cuck mindset. Almost like, I don't want to have to think about anything, because really what it boils down to is I want to oppress the people I view as undesirables, the people who I disagree with, whatever minority groups, right? The degenerates, trans types, liberals. I want to oppress these. So as long as a dictator is hating the people I hate and cracking down on them using the force of the state, that's really what I want. So it is a politics of hatred. That's what it is. These people are not in favor of creating a thriving society and country for everybody. They're not in favor of that. Never were, never will be. So you know what? Maybe go get a new hobby. Go become big into sports or whatever, because that sort of blind, idiotic tribalism and fandom works better over there than it does when you're trying to determine the future for everybody in the goddamn country. But now that they're letting their freak flag fly, I guess we should just say thank you. Because now, you know, nobody's going to accuse people like me of, oh, you're strawmanning them when you say this is what they believe. No, I'm not. They're just saying it now. They're just saying it. And so when I would make a point 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it seems kind of fascist. Well, now there really is no counter argument now, is there? Because now it's not my words, it's their words. I was just able to read between the line effectively a little while ago. But now you all know, because it's more than obvious. One of the things that the right has been really, really obsessed with for a while now is this idea of our kids are being groomed. And they have all sorts of arguments they make. They say, you know, trans people are grooming our kids. Drag shows are grooming our kids. Teachers are grooming their kids. They're really doing this moral panic as if there's societal pressure now for little Danny to say to his dad, Papa, I want to chop off my dick and balls now because it's a fad thing to do. This is what they're trying to get across, right? And again, they cloak it as this virtuous crusade for our kids. It's all about saving our kids. But it's interesting because every now and then a story will come out about how kids have been systemically abused. And what do you hear? Crickets. Did something happen? I didn't see anything happen. What are you talking about? Well, look at what we got here. More than 1,900 children abused by Illinois Catholic Church. This is according to a state investigation. The results were just released. 1,900. Did you have a pedophilia factory? Did you have an assembly line of pedophiles? 1,900. Over a period of about 7 decades, the Catholic Church in Illinois has allowed more than 450 credibly accused child sex abusers to have access to parishioners, the New York Times reported. 450. Guys, it's not like it was a whoopsie. Father James is a pedophile. Tee hee hee. Whoops. No. They knew it. The leaders knew it, and you know what they do? They'd shuffle them around from church to church, parish to parish. Oh, he got caught, went a little too far over here. Send him a couple states over. This is what they did. They say the figure is more than four times that which the church had publicly disclosed before 2018 when the state of Illinois began investigating the matter. The state's report found that clergy members and lay religious brothers abused at least 1,997 children since 1950 in the state's six dioceses. The report adds 149 names to lists of child sex abusers whom the diocese themselves had publicly identified before or during the investigation. That brings the total number of identified abusers to 451. The report says the additional names were supplied by victims who came forward and shared their accounts with investigators, who then followed up on their accounts. Investigators also reviewed more than 100,000 pages of files held by the diocese and interviewed church leaders and their representatives. One problem priest who was moved from parish to parish was Thomas Francis Kelly, who had abused more than 15 boys ranging in age from 11 to 17 during the 1960s and 1970s. Kelly's abuse was so prominent that it was a topic of discussion amongst the victim's peers, the Times reported. Before the report's release, the state's six dioceses released a statement claiming that the church has been at the forefront of dealing with sexual abuse of minors for many years. Mike McDonald, a spokesman for SNAP, an advocacy group for victims of clerical sexual abuse, responded to the statement saying that the state's report clearly tells us that no one knows more about abuse and no one did less about it than these dioceses themselves. I just want to remind you exactly what we're dealing with here. This was in Newsweek. It was from 2018. I believe we covered it at the time. The Catholic Church has paid nearly $4 billion over sexual abuse claims. $4 billion. You wonder why they paid $4 billion? Because they diddled countless children. That's why they paid $4 billion. Billion, with a B. With a B. Let me ask you a question. If liberal teachers had to pay out $4 billion because they sexually abused children as a matter of course, as a matter of standard operating procedure, what would the right be saying? What would they be doing? They would literally never shut up about it. By the way, nor should they. Nor should they. You had basically a sexual abuse factory in the Catholic Church. And shh, shh, shh. Nobody says anything. Nobody says anything on the right. It's almost like they don't really care about protecting kids from sexual abuse or from grooming. Because this is astonishing. Now, by the way, how many more victims are there? They had to pay out $4 billion. We're talking, what, millions of children? It really makes you wonder if there was like a directive, if there's a secret meeting of pedophile priests who are open about the fact behind closed doors. Yeah, the reason, one of the main reasons we're doing this is so we can get access to kids. Because these unsuspecting parents at the time, with, what do you mean? Yeah, like, if I send my kid to religious teaching and you had a priest teaching the class or whatever, this is a holy man of God. Of course they're going to do right by our kids. Of course we trust them. Literally the last people you should ever trust. Ever. So they say a nonprofit group that tracks allegations of abuse within the Catholic Church said Saturday that the church has paid out nearly $4 billion in lawsuits over allegations of clerical abuse since the 1980s. Bishop Accountability, whose mission is documenting the abuse crisis in the Roman Catholic Church, according to their website, says that there are also payouts involving over 8,600 cases of assault survivors abused by a member of the clergy dating back to the 1950s. 8,600 cases. That's just what we know of, bro. How many do we not know of? The largest known payout amounted to over $600 million in 2007. CNN reported on Saturday, issued on behalf of 221 priests and other church employees accused of abusing and victimizing over 500 people. This is astonishing. And by the way, the Catholic Church, their reputation will not take even the tiniest of hits. Because it's viewed as a mainstay institution now in the country. The church is untouchable in the same way that, like, broadly speaking, the government is untouchable. Or, like, big banks are untouchable. And this isn't even a blip on the radar. Not even a blip on the radar. People should be locked up. A lot of people should be locked up as a result of this. And if the right really cared about protecting kids, this would be what they talk about nonstop. Now, by the way, I'm not saying all Catholics are guilty of this. I mean, there's plenty of people who are Catholic. They just go to church and they're against this stuff and they hate this stuff and they couldn't believe this stuff when they heard it. This isn't an attack on regular people, but it absolutely is an attack on an institution. And think about how absurd it is. They got all this stuff about protecting kids, and the main culprit to these people is drag shows. Drag shows. They want to protect the kids from drag shows and send them to church instead. Which place is safer for the little ones? I'll leave you with that. Representative Bob Good is a Republican, and he decided to go on MSNBC and have a discussion about the debt ceiling. Now, Katie Turr is going to grill him here and ask him some very simple, straightforward questions that he has absolutely no answer to. Look, this is embarrassing. You are a representative, and you have no answer to these questions? So I'll play it for you, and then we'll react.
Path of fiscal responsibility.
Let me ask you,
the Biden-Schumer position is only supported by 20% of Americans.
Let me ask a question in here. I know you said that you would have voted for the Trump tax cuts. Would you vote to extend the Trump tax cuts?
Oh, absolutely, because, again, that is incentivizing... That's incentivizing the right things.
The CBO says,
that is key to $3.5 trillion
to the deficit.
We cannot sustain the 1-2% anemic Biden growth. We got to get back to 3-4%, the Trump growth patterns that was fueling our economy previously. So it's growth as well as cuts that'll get us on a path to fiscal stability.
Let me ask you a question about the deficit, though. If you are going to vote to extend those tax cuts, that's a $3.5 trillion add to the deficit per the CBO. That is a big addition. If you want to cut spending and you want to get us on a path to a balanced budget, I mean, it seems like that would be in conflict with your goal.
That's historically just inaccurate. Every time we cut taxes, we generate more growth. We generate more revenue. The Democrats predicted back in 2017 that when we had those tax cuts, we would have a reduction in revenue and therefore increase the deficit. And the Democrats lie and say that the deficit and the national debt has grown because of the tax cuts. That's simply not true. When revenue has a bottom line number, when you grow the pie, you only have to take a smaller percentage of it to fund your government. We've grown the pie, and that's why they've got record revenue coming in. We've never been $5 trillion a year in revenue until the last couple of years, and that is in large part because of the Trump economic policies, including the tax cuts.
It's not the Democrats. It's the CBO that says this. I'm not naming any Democrats. I'm giving you the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
At the end there, she's literally laughing in his face. She's laughing at him. She's laughing at him. What he's saying is a joke. So his argument is, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a deficit hawk and I'm a debt hawk, but I definitely want to continue the Trump tax cuts. Well, her point is, hold on one second. It added $2 trillion to the deficit. And if you want to continue it, it'll add $3.5 trillion. So you can't, those things don't add up. You can't say, hey, I'm a deficit hawk, but also continue the Trump tax cuts. You have to pick one. Either you prioritize the tax cuts or you prioritize the deficit and debt reduction. It's one or the other. They are mutually exclusive by definition. And what's it? Actually, see, the thing, what happened was the sun was in my eyes, and me and Craig and them was down by the Safeway, and when it's not even true that this adds to the deficit, it's the thing that when you cut taxes, it grows the economy, and so even though you're paying a lower rate, you get more revenue. But we have the historical record. What you're saying is not true. Who was the king of trickle-down economics? You all know this. There's another term for it. It's called Reaganomics. Or as George H.W. Bush used to call it, voodoo economics. Why do you call it voodoo? Because it doesn't actually, it's not, doesn't work. So what happened? Well, he cut taxes for the rich and he deregulated the economy. And we colossally exploded the debt and the deficit. Because it turns out when you cut taxes, you cut revenue into the government as well. That's what happens. It happened under Reagan. Don't take my word for it. Every chart out there will verify this. Reagan exploded the debt and the deficit. He exploded it. Record. Record debt and deficit at the time. Now, who's the next one who fully embraced trickle-down economics? You all know this too. George W. Bush. Cut taxes for the wealthy, deregulate the economy. Same thing. Record debt and deficit. Record. Because when you cut taxes for the wealthy, and by the way, you do two wars and put it on the credit card, it's going to explode the debt and the deficit. That's exactly what happened. Under Trump, same thing. Same thing. Every single time this is tried, this is the result. It is not true that, oh, you cut taxes for the rich and you'll unleash the beast of the free market economy and there will be so much growth that even though they're paying a lower rate, it'll actually be more revenue for the government and you won't increase, add to the debt and the deficit. It's not true. It's fundamentally not true. And he keeps trying to make it a partisan thing. Well, the Democrats are telling lies about this and that's why you keep bringing up what the Democrats say and it's not true. And she's like, I'm talking about the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan office. Sometimes stuff comes out of there that the Democrats don't like. But this is a fact that sticks in his craw because it makes his whole ideology and philosophy and economic outlook look stupid. You want to know why? Because it is. By the way, 83% of the benefits of that tax bill that he supports, the 2017 Trump tax cuts, 83% went to the top 1%. That bill incentivized corporate outsourcing from the president who said, I'm going to be the anti-outsourcing guy. It incentivized corporate outsourcing. And this is what he supports. You can't take any of these guys seriously. Rand Paul does this too, right? I'm a deficit hawk. I'm a dead hawk, but he supported these tax cuts as well. It's one or the other. It's one or the other. You have to pick. You can't have it both ways. And that's why somebody like Katie Turr, who, by the way, I don't even know how much I agree with her. I don't even know how smart I think she is or not. I don't know. Right? I'm not all that familiar with her, but you're making her laugh in your face because you have no clue what you're talking about, or you're just lying. Those are the only options. Nobody does the culture war more aggressively than the right does. So here we have a story coming out of the New York Post. Target holds emergency meeting over LGBTQ merchandise in Southern stores. Listen to this, guys. Some Southern Target stores were forced by the corporation to move LGBTQ pride merchandise away from the front of their locations after customer outrage to avoid a Bud Light situation. Of course, what they're referring to there is the Dylan Mulvaney situation where Bud Light hired a trans influencer to do an ad campaign with them, and there were Dylan Mulvaney faces on some of the beer, and then the right wing absolutely lost it over that and called it woke beer company or whatever. They continue here. Many Target locations across the country feature massive June Pride Month displays on an annual basis, with items this year ranging from tuck-friendly bathing suits for trans people to mugshots that say, mugshots. They sell mugshots at Target to mugs that say gender fluid. But the retail juggernaut has been criticized by some conservatives for the displays with children's items particularly irking many customers. A Target insider told Fox News Digital that many locations, mostly in rural areas of the South, have relocated pride sections to avoid the kind of backlash Bud Light has received in recent weeks after using a trans influencer in a promotional campaign. A Target insider said there were emergency calls on Friday, and some managers and district senior directors were told to tamp down the pride sections immediately. We were given 36 hours to take all of our pride stuff, the entire section, and move it into a section that's a third the size. So get rid of a lot of the, you know, pride-related merchandise and hide it. Hide it. Get it out of plain sight. Because we don't want to get yelled at by conservatives. It's scary to get yelled at by conservatives. Quote, we call our customers guests. There is outrage on their part. This year, it is just exponentially more than any other year. Huh. Interesting. The Target insider continued. I think given the current situation with Bud Light, the company is terrified of a Bud Light situation. So look, what does this mean? This means the right is now leaning harder and harder into culture war issues. By the way, they ran in the midterms in part on a trans panic and it didn't work. And same way they ran on the crime panic, didn't work. Didn't work. The results show it. So what do they do? Hey, let's double down on it. Let's lean in even harder. So this is a direct result of the Ben Shapiro stuff, the Matt Walsh stuff. And they like to think of themselves as we're serious people. Really? All you seem to talk about is culture war garbage. Is LGBTQ stuff, race stuff, gender, whatever. Like, that's all you talk about. How many segments can you do about being outraged over a Disney movie or some shit? Or some new superhero movie that has a black character in it? Or a gay character. Oh, you think you're serious? You think you're serious, people? You think that's fighting the power? God, it's so goddamn childish, man. But the fact that it's ramping up is genuinely scary. It is genuinely scary. Because it's taken hold, right? It's taken hold on the fringe among the extreme folks, and they're acting out over it. What kind of a person do you have to be to pick up the phone and angrily yell at some Target manager who makes 15 bucks an hour, right? Threaten violence or whatever over like pride flags being sold in the store. Can you imagine what on earth has gone wrong in your life where you're at that point? I mean, that is rock bottom, man. You're going to show up and protest it. You're going to make a phone call. You're going to threaten people over a pride section during Pride Month. Jesus. And by the way, this is how they divide us, right? In a world that made sense, we'd all be angry over the fact that we don't have a living wage. We don't have universal health care. We don't have nearly enough union protection. The rich pay a lower tax rate than working class people. This is the stuff that should be getting us outraged. Our illegal wars. This is the stuff that should be getting us outraged. But the right has successfully whipped the far right up into a frenzy over gay people existing and trans people existing. They say the insider who has worked at the retail store for almost two decades said Target rarely makes such hasty decisions. They said Friday's call began with roughly 10 minutes on how to deal with team member safety because the amount of backlash the Pride merchandise has generated, noting that Target, Asset, Protect, and corporate security teams were present on the call. So in other words, they're getting threats. They're getting threats over having Pride sections. And you know what? When you look at what just happened in Allen, Texas with the Nazi shooter, when you look at what happened with a U-Haul truck trying to storm into the White House, dude had a Nazi flag. You look at the increase in mass shootings and whatnot. I understand why they're freaking out, right? I get it. It's all under the guise of trying to increase swim sales, the insider said. Everyone was like, thank God, because we're all on the front lines dealing with it. Target did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Fox News Digital has confirmed rural Target stores in South Carolina, Arkansas, and Georgia are among the locations to move the Pride sections. Most rank-and-file employees were left in the dark, with many not knowing the Pride sections would be moved until they noticed it themselves. Pride merchandise remains prominently displayed at other locations and on the Target website. Target Pride merchandise includes female-style swimsuits that can be used to tuck male genitalia. Some products are also labeled as thoughtfully fit on multiple body types and gender expressions. Pride merchandise also includes onesies and rompers for newborn babies, a variety of adult clothing with slogans such as super queer, party supplies, home decor, multiple books, and a grow at your own pace saucer planter. I don't even know what those words mean. Bud Light says Bud Light sales have plummeted since backlash to the infamous partnership with transgender activist Dylan Mulvaney continues to haunt the company more than a month since it came to life. Look, you guys know the deal. The bottom line is, these are corporations. You know what they want? Money. You know what they want? Profit. They will do anything they think is the right thing to get them more profit. That's it. That's the whole trick. So why did Bud Light do that? I don't know. Sell some beer to trans people. We already got certain markets cornered, certain demographics cornered. Let's get a new one, right? That's what they thought. They didn't realize people had lost their goddamn minds, and the far right is so obsessed with the culture war and so anti-trans and anti-gay that there'd be a backlash over it. You know what? God bless them for being normal enough to not be obsessed with these issues. And then they saw it, they're like, oh, God damn. And so, yeah, they may have a decrease in sales or whatever now, but it'll bounce back. It always does. You're not going to take down a mega corporation like this through a boycott. How many other failed conservative boycotts have we seen? The only reason this is maybe landing more than other ones is because there is this very clear and rigorous campaign being waged by the likes of Matt Walsh types, Ben Shapiro types, and there's this wave of anti-trans bigotry. Also, you could say Ron DeSantis with all of his new laws he passed in Florida to crack down. That's all connected. But the end result here is devastating. You know? I mean, who would have thought at this late date we'd be moving backwards? On trans issues, maybe it's not as surprising, right? But on gay issues, it is kind of surprising. You felt like we hit a tipping point where it's like, yeah, everybody's, you know, gay marriage, all the polls show, whatever it is, 70, 75% of the country is now pro-gay marriage. Turns out, whatever the minority is, they're loud, they're aggressive, they're desperate, and they're threatening. And that's insane. It's just wild. So you guys know about the debt ceiling standoff, which has been happening with Democrats and Republicans. And Biden had taken a public stance of like, I'm not going to negotiate with these people. No, piss off. Now, that was the right stance. However, he was lying. As he was saying that publicly behind the scenes, he was negotiating with Republicans. Now, thankfully, Medicare and Social Security cuts are off the table. Why? Because Trump made it clear that nobody should cut these programs and no Republicans should cut these programs. And Biden also agreed with him. So those are off the table. But Republicans are basically asking for every other cut under the sun. They want work requirements tied into like SNAP, which is the food stamp program. They want to cut every other social safety net program that we have. And they want to do it substantially, by the way. So Biden is still entertaining that conversation. Now, in the context of the media talking about the debt ceiling, they have done an abysmal job. They've left out crucial facts, which would really help put things into perspective for your average normie American who might not know the most about this and is barely trying to follow along. So one of the things is, as you all know, the debt ceiling is, it's arbitrary. This is about the money we've already spent. The question is, are we going to basically be good on the money that we owe? That's the question. So when you frame it like that, it's like, will you just pay your debts? Well, then everybody's like, of course we should pay our debts. When you frame it as, we have this debt ceiling, should we cross it? People are like, no, definitely not. Should we cross it without doing spending cuts? People are like, no. Because when you phrase it in a way that doesn't give all the context, people don't know the way this stuff really works, right? And so Media Matters did a great breakdown here. They went through all the articles talking about the debt ceiling. And it shows you just how piss poor the coverage is and all the context they leave out. So look at this. Just six articles, which is 8% of the articles on this topic, mentioned that Republicans increased the current national debt significantly through their own tax and spending decisions, or mentioned that Republicans ran high annual budget deficits during the Trump administration. Six articles, 8% of the articles referenced that the Republicans have a recent track record of massively jacking up the debt and the deficit. Just 15 articles, or 19%, mentioned that Republicans routinely raised or suspended the debt ceiling during the Trump administration, or that Democrats supported those efforts. In other words, we've already done this a million times, because again, the debt ceiling is arbitrary. And Republicans did it too. No questions asked. Wasn't a big deal. They just did it because they know it's the right thing to do. They know it's the only thing we can do to avoid a great recession or depression and a massive economic calamity as a result of it. They just did it. But only 19% of articles mentioned that this is, they raised it a million times. They just raised it a whole bunch of times. Just 15 articles, or 19%, correctly mentioned that Republicans are responsible for the looming debt ceiling crisis due to their own intransigence and brinksmanship. I don't know why I can't talk. Brinksmanship. So in other words, Democrats are fine with a clean bill. Like, let's just lift it and get it over with. It's Republicans who are demanding, no, we want to cut programs for working people. That's the point that they're making. Now, to be fair, Democrats could have done this when they held the House and the Senate and the White House, which they just did before this last election. They could have done it themselves. Bernie said, hey, let's do this so we don't have a problem down the road. And Biden didn't do it. And the other Democrats yawned and didn't care. Well, great. Look where we are now. Just under half the articles, 46%, mentioned draconian cuts to federal spending being proposed by Republicans in exchange for a debt ceiling increase. That is unforgivable. So that means you're not even explaining the Republican position. Less than half of the articles are explaining that Republicans want cuts to programs for working people. How can you talk about the debt ceiling without bringing that up? That is like the main point. And they say a majority, 49 articles, or 63%, suggested that Republicans plan to default on U.S. sovereign debt obligations if the GOP's demands for substantial spending cuts and budget changes are not met. So look, this just goes to show you, the media is doing a terrible job giving you all the facts around this. And you wouldn't be that educated on what's going on if you just go by what the current articles are saying. You would need to have, you need to be familiar with the history of the various debt ceiling fights and non-fights to know how this works. It's honestly unforgivable. When, you know, you have to come to a loudmouth idiot YouTuber like me to get basic information on this current struggle, which is so important that the full faith and credit of the United States is on the line. Again, unforgivable. Now, you guys remember when inflation really took hold and became a big issue. There were all these different articles, mainstream articles on the topic. And look, the default view of a lot of the articles was like, oh, this is because of the big spending during COVID. That was the default view. And Many went even further than that and made the argument that this is specifically because of the money that helped working people. In other words, those $1,400 checks or the previous $600 checks, that was the taste they left in everybody's mouth. This idea that that's what's leading to inflation. God, we give people at the bottom and in the middle a little bit of money, and then the whole economy collapses. Man, we definitely shouldn't do that again. That was like the corporate media default perspective, right? Now, I fell for some of the propaganda, namely that, hey, these big spending bills during COVID, I could theoretically see how that leads to inflation, right? Big spending from the government. It makes sense intuitively, like, maybe, hey, that's probably what's leading to it. Well, I had a bunch of conversations behind the scenes at the time with people who are economists or just experts on this sort of stuff. I remember talking to Jeff Stein of The Washington Post, who, by the way, does a phenomenal job. He's a great reporter. And what they tried to impress upon me is that is not what's leading to inflation at all. You just fundamentally don't understand the situation if you think it's because of big government spending. In fact, what is much more likely is all of these supply chain woes that we have as a result of the pandemic, that's probably the biggest culprit. And then eventually we learned, oh my goodness, there's now this media hysteria over inflation. So corporations are using that hysteria to arbitrarily raise their prices to pad their bottom line and make more profit. And the term for that that was used was greedflation. It's just because corporations are greedy and they want to make more money. So they're saying, hey, we have to raise prices. And they raise prices, even though those particular goods, they're not actually being impacted by inflation. They're just raising prices to make more profit. And this tracked perfectly with a massive increase in corporate profits at the time. In fact, I believe it was Matt Stoller had an article. It was about 60% of inflation was literally just due to corporate greed and price gouging. So it's the effect of monopolies, it's the supply chain, and it's corporate greed. So look at this. This is amazing. So here we are a year later in Axios, they say. Once a fringe theory, greedflation gets its due. You don't say. Once dismissed as a fringe theory, the idea that corporate thirst for profits drives up inflation, aka greedflation, is now being taken more seriously by economists, policymakers, and the business press. Though inflation is starting to come down, it still remains well above the Fed's target level of 2%, and understanding what's causing inflation is key to combating it, now and next time. The idea that profits drove our current bout of inflation surfaced in the last few years among progressive economists and lawmakers, but was waved away by more mainstream types as a conspiracy theory that changed earlier this year. In a speech in January, then-Fed Vice Chair Lael Brainard, great name, said wages weren't the main driver of inflation and pointed to a price-price spiral, where companies mark up prices far higher than the increase in their input costs. In March, the chief economist at UBS Global Wealth Management, Paul Donovan, published a note on profit margin-led inflation, describing how in late 2022 and into this year, companies, particularly retailers and consumer goods makers, convinced customers that they needed to raise prices. They didn't really. Most of the time, these companies have weak pricing power, meaning they depend on repeat customers and can't just wildly increase prices because consumers will abandon them, he says. But businesses, both large and small, had a convincing story to tell. They really didn't want to raise prices, but there was this terrible war or the pandemic or labor shortage or whatever, Donovan tells Axios. That's what's basically been going on. With so much influx, people were more accepting of higher costs for everything, and more companies had to raise prices, and more convinced companies had to raise prices. In earnings conference calls last year, especially, executives spoke in corporate lingo about consumers accepting such price increases. Most folks aren't sticking with the greedflation label. That got a lot of blowback from those who argued that companies have long been greedy. That's not what's at play. Donovan's work describes companies taking advantage of a window of opportunity to raise prices more than normal, like kids in a candy shop. A few weeks after Donovan's paper came out, European Central Bank Executive Board Fabio Panetta expressed worries that inflation growth was due to increasing profits. So in other words, they go on to say, Bloomberg brought it up and said, hey, this is actually what's causing inflation. Wall Street Journal brought it up saying the same goddamn thing. Now remember, at the time when this was first brought up, all these people were scoffing. In fact, it was Larry Summers debating Jon Stewart over this, and Jon Stewart was like, wake up, dude. Wake up. We know what's leading to inflation. And he was denying it. He was denying it. But it turns out now it's conventional wisdom. Once viewed as a conspiracy theory, now it's conventional wisdom. And you know what? It was kind of clear all along, because all you had to do was see the tremendous increase in profits at the same time. That they're saying, we have to raise the prices. Well, if you have to raise the prices because you have more costs, then the profit margin wouldn't be going up so much now, would it? But it was going up. So again, what they did is they took the hysteria around inflation to then say, we have to raise all of our prices. And all the companies did it across the board. So there was nobody undercutting the other corporations. So it was basically this silent agreement among all the companies. Let's just rip everybody off for a while. Let's just price gouge everybody for a while. And that's what they did. And again, Matt Stoller was onto it early. He said about 60% of inflation is due to corporate price gouging. And there were a number of articles, including in Business Insider at the time, which is usually a business-friendly outlet, right? They had an article listing specific corporations and exactly how they're doing it. And we covered that at the time. So it turns out corporations are greedy and manipulative and they lie. And it's anything to increase that bottom line. That means shaking everybody down in the entire country. God damn it, they'll do it. And what did our government do? Sat around and did nothing. And if anything, they blamed workers getting a little extra money during a pandemic to then turn around and say, maybe we got to embrace austerity now because you guys got too much money and that's what's leading to inflation. So it was a double whammy. The workers got hit because of the inflation, because of the price gouging of the companies. And then also the government turned around and said, we're never going to give you guys any more money. That's crazy. We have everything ass backwards in this Congress. Everything is ass backwards. What you needed to do, and Bernie brought this up at the time, is what's called a windfall profits tax. Oh, you want to take this moment of chaos to just price gouge and make more money? Okay, we're just going to tax back however much more you're charging and redistribute it back to the people. That's what we're going to do, windfall profits tax. But they didn't do that. Of course they didn't do that. Biden didn't even consider it. So anyway, you guys get it. It's infuriating, isn't it? When you bring something up, you know it's real because the evidence shows it, but the mainstream media and mainstream economists scoffed at it and swatted it away. But now they've all come around. Well, I guess that's better than them never coming around, but it is what we call too little, too late. Okay, guys, that's the show. I love y'all very much as always. Thank you for listening. Everybody do me a big favor, click like, click subscribe, click that bell icon so you get a notification every single time a video drops. That helps us get around the algorithm from crushing us. Remember, you can always listen to the full audio version of the show on Spotify. We upload the full audio podcast over there, so enjoy that if you want to listen that way as opposed to going video for video on YouTube. And much love to everybody who supports this show on Patreon, everybody who tips this show through the thanks button below, everybody who supports Crystal Kyle and friends. And remember, we always welcome your support because I never talk to any corporations or any advertisers. I don't want to do that as a matter of principle. We like building it bottom up. So yeah, that's all I got for you guys. I love y'all and I will talk to you soon. Peace.